Good afternoon.
We are on to sheet 13, and we're starting a new topic today. We're getting into the issue of machlokes, which is fascinating, which is how can there be multiple opinions, which is right, which is wrong. And what we're going to see, hopefully, over the next couple of shiurim, is that there is such a thing as good machlokes and there's such a thing as bad machlokes. Good machlokes, if you like, is built into the system. It's not a product of some kind of faults or mistake or lack of learning or attention. It's a product of the system itself having within it a certain pluralism. We'll define that, how that works. And that we might call sort of good machlokes. But then there's also bad machlokes. Bad machlokes comes out of people's inability to learn properly, a certain breakdown in the ability to focus and to see things from a clear perspective. And we'll see next time that is part of the machlokes that crept in towards the end of the Second Temple period. And these two different kinds of debate, dispute, machloket, come through the system together and play out as we move into the more modern era. Today we're focusing on the former, the good machloket. It's a bit like cholesterol, you know, you've got good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. You have to work out which of them is higher than the other. Hopefully the good machlokes is the higher one. We are dealing here with the basic questions as to what does the Torah say about itself in terms of multiple truths. Is there a right answer? A girl from a different seminary was saying to me this morning, surely when Mashiach comes, then we won't have any more machlokes. Everybody will agree what we should do. Okay? And I said, I didn't think that was necessarily the case at all. Maybe there won't be any, quote-unquote, bad machlokes in the sense of things that are not agreed upon for all the wrong reasons of exile, etc. But I think built into the system that we'll see now is definitely a machlokes focus. That sounds like a machlokes focus. Okay, fine. We coined a new phrase. Let's go. The starting point for this debate is a very obscure pasuk at the end of Qoheles. Excuse me. The verse at the end of Qoheles says, I was walking in and out, by the way. The verse at the end of Qoheles says this follows. Now this won't make a lot of sense to you until we've gone into it, but it will hopefully become elucidated. Divrei Chachamim Kedar Boinois. The words of the rabbis, says Qoheles, are like prods, like cattle prods. You know those little sticks with a metal tip, and you stick it in your cow, and he goes off down the does some ploughing down the road. So they're sharp. They have a certain they have an impetus that they get you to move. Ukamasmerois, they are like nails. Netuim, but they are planted, which is funny because they're like organic nails. Okay, baale asufot, the masters of the gatherings. Nitnu, they are given, miroe echad, from one shepherd. Now, in and of itself, it's a bit difficult to actually translate that pasuk into English. Dictionaries and that certainly won't do it. Just pass me your Tanakh for a second. Let's see what Rabbi R. Scroll does with this pasuk. See how he translates it. No. Rabbi Arthur Scroll. No, he doesn't really exist. Okay. So the here. The translation he gives it here, right at the end of Qoheles, is as follows. Let's see what he says here. The words of the wise are like goads, okay, cattle prods, and the nails well driven are the sayings of the masters of collections coming from one shepherd. Doesn't make a lot more sense, quite frankly, in the best possible translation that they've given you. The Gemara, however, is going to give a lot of explanation to this and tell you what it's all about. So have a look at number two. Ba'alei asufos. I've skipped, if you like, to the end of the pasuk. What does it mean that the well-planted words of the rabbis are coming from the lords of the gatherings? Eilu tamidei chachamim sheyoshvim asufos asufos. These are the rabbis that sit in groups, different groups, asufos asufos. Okay? Oiskim v'toira, and they're learning Torah. Halalu matameim, halalu matarim. One group says tamei, the other group says tahor. Halalu oisim v'halalu matirim. One group says also is prohibited. One group says mutar. Halalu poislim v'halalu machshirim. One group says pasul, it's invalid. One group says kasher. These are, if you like, the six axes of halachic debate: tamei, tahor, pure, impure, pure, pasul, kasher, invalid, valid, and asur, mutar, and are prohibited and permitted. In different scenarios, these are the terms employed in the debate. Shema Yoma Adam, a person could turn around and say, Hey Chani Lama Torah Me'ata, how can I learn this kind of Torah? And it's not asking a practical question, whoa, how do I paskin? Because he said it's okay and he said it's not. Because the answer to the practical question is, why are you asking 10 rabbis? Aselech HaRav, get yourself one rabbi and ask him, and then you'll know the answer. Someone with two watches never knows the right time. So don't get two watches, get one watch, you'll know the right time, you'll be happy. So the question the Gemara is not asking is not a practical question. It's asking a principal, theoretical, philosophical question. Well, what kind of a Torah is this? This Torah where everyone's saying different things? I don't trust this. It doesn't give me confidence that everyone's saying different things. How can I learn this kind of Torah? Talmud Leimer, the answer is, the Pasuk says, Kulam nitnu miroi echas. Don't worry, they're all given from one shepherd. Keil echad nitna. One God gave them. Parnas echad amram, one leader said them. From the mouth of the Lord of all deeds, okay? They all came from God. God said all of these things. And therefore, even though they're all these rabbis are saying different things, on a certain level they're all coming from God. Which isn't really answering the question, how are they all coming from God? But it's saying, don't worry, so somehow there's a dichotomy here. They're all saying different things, but they're all coming from a reliable source. Don't think that the rabbis are making it up. It's not going to give us the exact answer to the problem, but we will get to that as we get through. But then the Gemara says an interesting thing. It's Gemara Chagiga. Make your ears like an afar cheses. An afar cheses is like a big funnel. Think of like one of those old-fashioned trumpets, like hearing trumpets that people used to use. Or they bring down, it's like a funnel into the grindstone in the mill, where you throw all the corn in the top, and it funnels it into a little thing at the bottom. Wide at the top and narrow at the bottom. Uknel chalev, and get yourself a brain. Okay? Maybe. That can understand life. And listen to all of them, listen to all the opinions, the ones who say it's impure, the ones who say it's pure. In other words, you have to listen to everybody's opinion. You have to take it all in like a big funnel, but get yourself a brain that can understand and work out the difference between all these things. What's going on? What does this mean? So I want to bring you two episodes, quite famous episodes from the Gemara, that really raised this question and coined this phrase, which we're going to be using, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and these are, well, how are you going to translate that? Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. What does divrei Elokim chayim mean?
The words of the living God.
Either the words of the living God, or divrei Elokim chayim, meaning? The living words of God. There's a built-in, if you like, ambiguity in the phrase. It's either the words of the living God or the living words of God. What does the word chayim mean in Hebrew? I know it means living, but in what is the connotation of the word chayim?
Like, I don't know. Renewal?
Yeah, renewal, that's right. Mayim chayim, the expression mayim chayim, living waters, is the expression used in halakha, or in the Psukim and in Halakha, for a bubbling spring. There's two kinds of mikveh, if you like. Well, one's a mikveh, one's a mayan. A mikveh is still water, which is collected together. It has a mikveh mayim, a gathering of water. And a mayan is mayim chayim, which is bubbling. For halachic reasons, sometimes you need a mikveh, sometimes you need a mayan. It's interesting questions where, but that's not for today. Divrei Elokim chayim, it sounds like on some level, the words of God are constantly bubbling. They're constantly renewing. They're constantly refreshing. So let's have a look and see how that works out and how that connects to what we said in number two. These are two episodes, and you'll have heard of both of them. You'll have heard more of the second one, but we have to learn both of them. Number three, very famous and quite exciting Gemaras. Amar Rav Abba Amar Shmuel. 3 years, Beis Shammah and Beis Hillel disagreed. Now, we will get to, when we look at the historical context here, why was it that Beis Shammah and Beis Hillel were fundamentally disagreeing with each other? And there's an element of bad machlokas in this as well. But for now, we're focusing on, if you like, just the principle of the good machlokas. Beis Shammah and Beis Hillel were disagreeing for 3 years. Halalu omrim halacha k'moyseinu, v'halalu omrim halacha k'moyseinu. One group said, no, the halacha's like us. And one group says, no, the halacha's like us. And by the way, this was very serious. This was not just a friendly debate within the yeshiva. The Torah case turned almost into two Torahs. This was a schism in the making. You almost had Beis Shammai Judaism and Beis Hillel Judaism. Very serious. Yatsa Baskol. A Baskol came out. Now, what's a Baskol? A voice from heaven. What kind of voice from heaven?
Lady's voice.
A lady's, not just a lady's voice, but a daughter's voice. The daughter of a voice. What you're dealing with here, the Mefarshim say, is this is not a nevuah. Nevuah, it works in a different way. This is a kol. This is some communication from Shamayim, from Siyata the Shamayim. But it's a weakened voice. First of all, it's a second generation. It's a bat or a ben. It's a child of a voice. And it's a bat kol. It's not even a ben kol. Meaning it's a subtle. The Chazal's assumption is that women were often a little more subtle than men, in the sense that, or it's a slightly less in-your-face voice. It's a more of an understanding that the people got, but this bass call came and the people understood it. It wasn't, I don't think, like voices screaming out from the walls. That's not what we're talking about. So Amra and said, look, Elu ve'elu, Divrei Elokim Chaim Heim. These and these are the living words of God. The halacha ke Beis Hillel, but the halacha follows Beis Hillel. So Gemara asked, "V'kimaach she'elu be'elu divrei Elokim Chaim? If these and these are the living words of God, why did Beis Hillel end up with a halacha like that? It seems a bit random." So it answers, because they were extremely obliging and foregoing, and they were very, they had enormously positive midas. Meaning what? They would always quote the other side's opinion when they quoted their opinion. Not only this, they would quote the other side's opinion before they quoted their opinion. And indeed, usually in the Mishnah, when Rebbe, who was from Beis Hillel, quotes Beis Shammai, he quotes Beis Shammai before Beis Hillel, almost always. Okay, and he was from Beis Hillel. Now, it's interesting. I'm not going to get into the whole debate as to why it is that their approach in, if you like, midot, is a reason for them to have the halacha paskin like them. I mean, you could say that this was indicative of a certain intellectual breadth or honesty that would allow them to see both sides of the coin. You could argue that actually there are good intellectual reasons to follow a group of people who are more broad, if you like, and open and accepting. I'm not getting into that right now, but this Baskol coined the phrase Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim Heim, which doesn't appear many times at all in Shas, only very, very few times here, and also there's another main appearance coming up in the Gemara in Gittin, in number 12. And everybody accepted this. And historically, Beis Shammah, Beis Hillel, the schism never happened, and everybody went away and was happy, and indeed, Beis Hillel became the dominant psak, to the point that Beis Shammah's psak became a non-psak. It wasn't even a minority opinion. It was a complete non-opinion. You have no business paskening, ruling like Beis Shammai now, because the Beis Hillel said the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Even though on some level Beis Shammai's view was Divrei Elokim Chaim as well. Okay, thanks. Number 4 is the Gemara that goes alongside that. It's a Gemara elsewhere in Bava Metzia, and it's about something called the Tanur Shel Achanoi. Yes.
So in the part where both are Divrei Elokim, is that the part where it's beyond understanding?
What do you mean? Well, it's not beyond our understanding. We're going to try and get to an understanding of what that means that they're Divrei Elokim Chaim. We'll see if we can try and understand that. We're not just going to leave it as a mystical dichotomy. We're going to try and give some understanding to it. Look at number 4. This is dealing with a certain kind of oven, a tanur shel achnoi. This kind of oven, the debate is whether it is susceptible or not to tumma. I'm not getting into the exact details of the oven. Basically, it was an oven made from parts. One of the general principles in the halacha of tumma v'tahara is if something is made of bits and is detached, and the bits are taken apart, that's one of the ways that you actually purify something which is tameh. Okay? So this oven is made not of one big piece of earthenware, but of lots of little pieces of earthenware put together like rings. If they imagine concentric rings on top of each other. But between each of the rings, there's like a layer of sand. Okay? And the question is, does that, if you like, join them, or are they still separate? That's a debate. And I'm not getting into the ins and outs of the debate. If you want, you can look in the Maseches Kelim, and there it debates. It brings this Mishnah, which deals with this Tanur Shel Achnoyim. Tanan Hasam. Chatchu Chulios, you cut the oven into rings. V'nasan Chol, and then you put sand, Bein Chulia L'Chulia, between one ring and the next ring. This was the debate. Rabbi Eliezer Matahel. Rabbi Eliezer says, Tahor, the oven is not subject to impurity. It's broken. The Chachomim Metameh. And the Chachomim say, no, the oven is capable of becoming Tameh, or if it was like that, it remains Tameh, it's not called broken. Fine. We see like this. Ba'oisa, Tana, Ba'oisa Hayom, Heshiv Rebbe Eliezer called Shuvah Sheba Oilam. On that day when they had this debate, Rebbe Eliezer gave every answer he could to persuade them that the oven was actually Tahor. But like Kim Lohemenu, and they would not accept his arguments. Amar Lehem, and then he said to them, Im alocha kemoisi, if the alocha is like me, choruv ze yuchiach, this carob tree will prove that I'm right. Neka choruv mimakoma mea amma, and the carob tree uprooted itself and ran 100 amas down the road. Now, this is a midrashic story, guys. This is meant to be representing certain ideas, not necessarily if you'd have been taking a video of this whole thing. I'm not sure you'd have seen trees running around, but that's a question of how to read the midrash, how to read Agadata. And I think that's even backed up by the next line, which says, "Va'amrila." Other people argue, "Arba meas ama." They actually, the carob tree ran 400 amas down the road. Now, like, I would ask you, if already the carob tree ran 100 amas down the road, I'm not any more impressed by the fact that it runs 400 amas down the road.
How much is run?
You know, you can see clearly from here, they're not arguing about just how big a miracle it was, but these numbers represent things. 100, 400, what that means, and therefore if we were to learn this Midrash Be'iyun, then I would want to really go into all of that, look in the Meforshim, etc., etc. So whenever you're learning in Agadata like this, always have your ears, your radar screen on to try and understand the subtle references here. Now, Amruloi, they said to him, Einevin Raim in a Charuv. Sorry, we don't bring halachic proofs from a carob tree. Chazar v'amalahem, he said to them again, Im halacha kemoisi, amasamayim yuchichu, if the halacha is like me, then the water channel will prove it. V'chazar amasamayim l'achareihem, and the water started running uphill, backwards. Okay? Amrullah, they said to him, Ein mevin raya me amasamayim, we don't bring a proof from a water channel. Chazar v'amalahem, then he said to them, Im halacha kemoisi, kos lebeis ha-medrash yuchichu. If the halacha is like me, the Beit Midrash walls will prove it. And Hatuva Kaislav Vesamedrish Lipol, and the walls started falling in, started collapsing inwards, so that they were kind of collapsing down onto them. Garbahem Rabbi Yeshua. Now we see Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua was the leader of the group that we called just before the Chachamim. Rabbi Yeshua turns to the walls and rebukes the walls. Amalahim, he said to them, excuse me? Im Talmid Chachamim Menatchim Zeh Zeh, Zeh B'Halacha. If groups of Talmid Chachamim are arguing about the Halacha, what's it got to do with you? It's through the walls. So what happened? Loinaflu. So they stopped falling with Nekvodashal Rabbi Yeshua because of out of respect for Rabbi Yeshua. But Veloizakfu, but they didn't go back up again, did Nekvodashal Rabbi Yezer because of respect for Rabbi Yezer. So the walls are now suspended in some kind of a diagonal form. Fine. Ba'adain Martin Loim. And they stayed just like they were. So Rabbi Yezer is not doing too great here. He's trying to prove his argument. He's given all the halachic arguments he can. They were rejected. There's now a tree running up and down the road. There's water running up the hill. And the walls of the Beit Midrash are kind of suspended over their heads. So he's going to bring this to an end. How long can this go on? So he said like this. Chazar amalahem, he then says to them, Im halacha kemoisi min hashamayim yuchif. Oh, they will prove it from heaven. What happened? Yatza baskol. Just when you need one, that call comes out. Va'amran says, Malachem etzel Rabbi Eliezer. Why are you arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? Shalacha kemos b'chol makom. We paskin like him in Shamayim. The halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer. Why are you arguing with him? Amud Rabbi Yeshua, Raglav Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet, Va'amran, he said, Loi v'shamayim hi. It's not in heaven. That's a quote from a verse in Devarim. Okay? So the Gemara says, My Loi v'shamayim hi. What does it mean, Loi B'Shamayim? What did he mean by that? Amar Rabbi Yirmi, who a later generation, explains what he meant by that. Shekvar nikna Torah mehar Sinai. The Torah was already given on Har Sinai. Ein anu mashkichim bebaskol. We're not interested in heavenly voices. Shekvar kasafta b'Har Sinai. You already wrote God in your Torah, b'Torah. Achrei rabim lahatzvayis. Follow the majority. Follow the majority. And therefore, Rabbi Yeshua and the Chachamim were the majority. Rabbi Eliezer was the minority. I don't care if you can bring miracles to prove your halachic point. At the end of the day, you're the minority and we're the majority, and we have the halacha like us. And I don't even care, said Rabbi Yeshua, if you can bring a voice from heaven. Even if God passes like you, I'm not interested. Because God passes like me, because he told me in the Torah, follow the majority. So, you know, which is it? You choose which statement from God you want to choose, but as far as we're concerned, we'll go with the Torah, you can go with the heavenly voices. As a postscript, the Gemara now says, Ashkei Rabbi Nosson, who lived a couple of generations later, we found Eliyahu and Novi, always a handy guy to find if you need an insight into something heavenly. Of course, Eliyahu Novi never died. He went up to Shamayim in a chariot, and he's now, if you like, accessible for those who know how to access him. Amalei, he said to him, okay, Ma'avit kutshabrichu ba'ishaisa. What was God doing just at this moment? Just an interesting question. And Eliyahu answered him, okay, Amalei said to him, kachayich, he was laughing, smiling. Va'amar, and he was saying, nitzchuni banai. My children have beaten me, my children have beaten me. And he was laughing. Just schlepping nachas from the Jewish people. Very fascinating Agadita. And by the way, I didn't bring you the next bit of the Agadita, which they turned around to Rabbi Eliezer and they said to him, okay, now we've got through all this, will you agree? And Rabbi Eliezer said, no, because I'm right.
Wow.
And they said, okay, well then that's the end. And every single heksher that Rabbi Eliezer ever gave to anything, they withdrew. They put him in cherem, and they said, you have no place anymore in the debate, in the halachic debate. And they excluded him from the community. And that indeed went on until his dying day. Rabbi Eliezer never came back into the community. And you ended up with this extremely awkward situation where Rabbi Akiva, who was a student of both Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, was running kind of back one to the other, trying to make shalom and trying to help things. And in the end, Rabbi Eliezer died a very angry, bitter, very upset at the whole way that he was treated and the whole debate. So it wasn't a story with a happy ending in actual life. If you want to read more about this, I'll tell you who has a very good work on this, Rabbi Benny Lau. Benny Lau, who is a rabbi here in Baca, he wrote a very interesting series of books called Chachamim in Hebrew, and they've been translated into English, and he explores the personalities and the interface and the interrelationship between these people, and he spends quite a lot of time on Rabbi Shua and Rabbi Eliezer. So if you're interested in reading about this in a more, if you like, a bit more modern approach, not everybody is into this approach, it's a bit kind of analytical and academic, but it's very interesting for those who like it. You can pick up the books in Stamatskis or whatever, they're a very interesting read. Yes?
How is this midrash meant to be taken in terms of, like, obviously, parts that are like, this is the way it actually happened, and parts that are like a midrash. Like,
right. In other words, the midrash is setting up a debate between Rabbi Shua and Rabbi Eliezer, which represents the underlying essence of the global halachic argument between them. What's really going on in the Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua massive political struggle that was going on, a halachic struggle at the time? Because these were two real individuals who had a very, very serious disagreement on the way that halacha worked in his own time. And I think what's happening is the Gemara is creating this episode, this midrashic, this agadic episode, to really give you the underlying reality, the MS, as to what's really going on. We could do that today, really, you know? Someone once said, If they were Rabbi Beryl Wine was expected like midrash like this. If they were writing midrash today, I think this is really a little bit beyond your frame of reference now. But you know Natan Sharansky, yeah, Natan Sharansky. You don't know Natan Sharansky, okay, fine. Anatoly Sharansky was one of the main refuseniks in the Soviet Jewry in the 1970s-80s. Okay. And he was under arrest for multiple times. He was in the gulag. He had the whole works. Eventually he was released. It was a very famous release. They walked him over the bridge. I remember watching it on the TV there. And they told him, everything the Russians told him to do, he did the opposite. He was a daftkinik as well as a refusenik. Okay? They told him, walk in a straight line down the bridge. So he walked like this down the bridge as he went over the bridge. It was very, very interesting. Anyway, so there was a story once that he was sitting in a cell being interrogated by the KGB. So there were two KGB agents, and one of them, they were asking questions. So he said, let me tell you something. And he told an extremely rude joke about Brezhnev, or whoever it was that was in charge of them. Like, really outrageously rude. And the senior KGB officer sat there looking at him, like in horror. And the junior KGB officer started cracking up. But he couldn't laugh. So he was going on like this. And Sharansky turned around and said, ah, who's free? You're free or I'm free? Tell me who's free in this debate and who's really under duress and arrest. And Rabbi Wein said if they'd been writing a midrash about the Soviet jury, they'd say, Natan Sharansky destroyed the Soviet Union. Okay, they might have written it like that. Now, 2,000 years later, you'd have looked and you said, Natan Sharansky had like weapons and he destroyed the Soviet Union. No. What it's really saying is, at the roots of what brought down the system, what was it that brought down the system? Was it the geopolitical realities, Glasnost and Brezhnev and what's his name? Gorbachev and Perestroika and that whole thing. Was it that? Or was it the resistance of certain key individuals who took out the foundations from within? That would be a midrashic statement. Sharansky destroyed the Soviet Union. So again, you have what they're trying to communicate here is an emes, an underlying emes into what's going on. Now, I have a number of questions on this. First of all, there's an obvious question about the Baskol. The question is?
Prior to it, it had,
See if you have a memory of more than 7 minutes.
Prior to it, exactly.
In source number 3, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. I always wanted to teach goldfish, it's alright. In Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, they paskened like the Baskol, okay? And then everyone went home happy. Oh, Baruch Hashem, a Baskol, tell God us what to do. And in the case of Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Shur, all of a sudden, oh, you're joking. We're going to follow a Baskol. We're not going to follow a Baskol. So how can you follow a Baskol there and not follow a Baskol here? Why does El Rabbi Eliezer call on this Baskol? Why doesn't he follow the majority? What's his problem with following the majority? And the Gemara doesn't seem to be saying... The Gemara doesn't say, by the way, here, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chai. The Gemara here says, the voice came out from heaven, the Rabbi Eliezer was right, but they ignored it anyway.
They get punished for it afterwards? Like, did Rabbi Eliezer get excommunicated and then suffer a horrible life for a long time?
Correct. I said he got excommunicated, and also the way he was treated, the Gemara asked whether he was treated right. But in principle, they did the right thing.
But didn't they get punished for it afterwards?
No. They didn't get punished. Rabbi Eliezer, certain things happened that they felt were as a result of Rabbi Eliezer's treatment, maybe. Rabbi Eliezer was too important a person to just kind of shove into the sidelines. But in principle, the Gemara is not setting this up to criticize Rabbi Yeshua. It's on the contrary, to criticize Rabbi Eliezer. Why won't he listen to the majority? But on the other hand, how can we ignore God's truth? God comes down from heaven and says, you know, can you imagine, like some heavenly voice came out and said, you know, Midrashet Rachel is right, the others are wrong. You know what I mean? Whatever that might mean. They're going to ignore that? Ah, Loi B'Shamayni, we don't care. How can we ignore that? And how can God get pride out of the fact that we ignore Him? You know, you could really build a case for, you know, typical Jews, you know? They ignore God and God, and they think God likes that, you know? They should be doing what God says. So I want to give you one short introduction to our approach to this. Turn over on page 2, please. Look at the Tosfos. There's a Tosfos on the Sugi and Erubin that asks, why do we listen to the Gemara, to the Baskol in Erubin with the Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, but we don't listen to the Baskol in Bava Metzia when it comes to Rabbi Shur Rabbi Yez? And he asks an interesting question, looking at number 5. The Imtaimeh, if you want to ask, My shana the loy kaimalanka bas called Rebbe Eliezer. Why don't we listen to the bas called with Rebbe Eliezer, but we do listen to the bas called with Beis Hillel Beis Shammai? So he gives a very interesting answer. He says, Yesh loyma, that you could answer, Dehasam haisa keneged rabbim. Over in the case of Rebbe Eliezer, he was one versus the majority. The bas called came out with the minority. The HaTorah amra achri rabbim lehatis, but the Torah says you can't follow the minority. Aval hacha ad rabba. Here, on the contrary, in Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, who was the majority? Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. Hillel was clearly the majority. Beis Hillel was clearly the majority. Other Rabbah, Beis Hillel have a ruba. Beis Hillel was the majority. That's why we follow the Bas Kol. But now you're going to ask me, well, if Beis Hillel was the majority, why do they need a Bas Kol? They don't need a Bas Kol. They should have just said, Achrei Rabbim Lahatos, follow the majority, leave it out. Says the loy hutzuch a bas kol. The only reason they needed a bas kol is ele mishum de Beis Shammai havu charif beitzve. The Beis Shammai were more charif. What does charif mean? Spicy, but really it means sharp. It means sharp, and here it means sharp in an intellectual way. In other words, Beis Shammai's argument were: sure, you're the majority, but we're cleverer than you, and we think you're wrong. Not only do we think you're wrong, but we know you're wrong. And don't tell us that the Torah wants us to follow the majority when the majority is wrong. And Beis Hillel said to Beis Shammai, look, you know, what can we tell you? We understand that you're brilliant, but we are the majority and we're not so stupid ourselves, you know. We are Beis Hillel, which are like the leading brains of Klal Yisrael. It's not like we're just making a silly mistake. You don't agree with us, but you have to go with our psak because we're the majority. So Beis Shammai turned around and say, no, sorry. We need something. We go with an objective truth, and objectively we're right. So Beis Hillel say, fine, Bas Kol, come tell them, you tell them. And the Bas Kol comes out and says, halacha's like Beis Hillel. And Beis Shammai go, okay. A Bas Kol will listen to. If the Bas Kol tells us the majority is right, okay, so then we know that the Torah wants you to follow the majority, even when the majority is, in your view, not the correct answer. Now, two generations later, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, having basically the same argument, if I ask you to place Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua with Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, which is Rabbi Eliezer? Beis Shammai, and indeed he is called a Shamuti. He's called a Shammainik, a Shammai person. And Rabbi Yeshua was the head of the Beis Hillel, if you like, what was the remnants of the Beis Hillel group, the head of the Sanhedrin. And Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua are having this debate all over again. But this time, it's not the same, because it's already been decided by the Bas Kol. The Bas Kol's already said, I'm sorry, you follow the majority. But Rabbi Eliezer still won't have it. Rabbi Eliezer says, look, you're wrong. I'm not going to listen to you if you're wrong, because I know that I'm right. And here even, he brings the Bas Kol to show that he's right. And Rabbi Yeshua says, I'm sorry, we're not going to follow a Bas Kol against the majority. In the case of Hillel and Shammai, the Bas Kol was just backing up the Torah. Here the Bas Kol is coming to tell us some truth from heaven. That's not relevant to us, because the majority has to win. And that seems to be the conclusion. The question is, how does that work? And God seems to want that answer, because God says, my children have beaten me, my children have beaten me. Because my children have learned that they need to ignore me when they decide the halacha is not like me.
Like, after Matan Torah, two weeks later, the majority decided to worship the golden calf, so we're supposed to be like, okay.
I understand. So you're asking, first of all, some good things. On the last point you made, no one ever suggested the majority means the majority of the people. The majority means the majority of the Sanhedrin. Because obviously, when you just go with the majority of the people say all sorts of funny things. Let's go back to Egypt. Okay, it's not like some kind of democracy. The majority of the Sanhedrin determines the truth. Although, as I said to you last week, the Sanhedrin itself is to a certain degree dependent on the will of the people and the support of the people. So the people are not out of the picture, but they're not direct. It's not like a referendum on every question. Just open the window a little bit, will you? Don't mind a little bit. You won't get cold, I promise.
Oh.
And if you do get cold, you can always close it again.
Okay,
just lets a bit of air in, lets you know, to give us that 20 minutes more oxygen that we need. Okay, so the majority is not just the majority, any old majority, but in terms of intellectual integrity. So there's an interesting question. Clearly what's happening here is there's a genuine difference of opinion. It's not like Beit Hillel are just making a mistake. Just making a silly mistake. Beit Hillel are saying, no, look, we've analysed it. This is genuinely how we view it. You just don't agree with us.
Or maybe they're just not smart enough to see it.
Okay, or maybe they're just not smart enough to see the way that Beit Shammai say. And the fact that we're not smart enough is actually irrelevant, because we don't go by the smartest people, we go by the majority, it seems. As long as the majority is not just making a clear error. And no one, by the way, claims infallibility. The Sanhedrin is not infallible. There's an entire sugya, an entire parsha in Vayikra that deals with what happens if the Sanhedrin makes a mistake. If the Sanhedrin makes a mistake, they have to bring a korban to apologize, to say to the to do tshuva, the fact that we made a mistake and now we've corrected our mistake, and the people are all, you know, included in that tshuva. Although the Rambam, in fact, writes that if the Sanhedrin make an obvious error and the Talmud Chacham knows that they made an error but still follows them anyway, because they say, well, look, they're the Sanhedrin, who am I to disagree? He is not included in the korban that they bring to apologize for the error, because he should have known better than to follow them. So it seems that we're not talking about an obvious error. We're talking about a difference of view. Beit Shammai think this, Beit Hillel think this. And the question is, this is in some ways legitimizing both views. No one turned around. The Gemara is not saying Rabbi Eliezer is wrong. On the contrary, Rabbi Eliezer is right on a certain level. But that's not the correct halachic answer. So let's understand now how that works. And there are a number of models for explaining this this whole Elu ve'Elu issue. There's what you might call pluralistic models, and there's what you might call monistic models. Pluralistic means that there are built-in different approaches to truth, and monistic means there is really one truth, we just have to try and get it, and there are rules as to how we get the truth, and we either get it or we miss it. You had a question?
Yeah, let's just say we're the other way, where Rabbi Eliezer thought that the other would be...
It doesn't make any difference. It's not because he was lenient or because he was strict.
No. My question is, like, let's just say the correct one was that it would be Tameh.
Right.
But the majority said it was Tahor.
Right.
So then people started using it because of the majority.
Right.
So then all of a sudden, did the oven become Tahor?
Yes.
Okay.
Psak is that the oven is Tahor, the oven is Tahor. And when we deal with Psak Halacha later in the year, when we get there, okay, in Shir like 35 or something like that, when we deal with Psak Halacha, we'll see that the Psak Halacha creates a reality. If you bring me a chicken, not me because I work Paskin on a chicken, but in the old days they always talk about bringing chickens. People used to bring a lot of chickens to the rabbis. You know, you bought a chicken in the butcher and you picked it up and it looked like kind of the wing was a bit broken, like, you know, whatever. And you went to the rabbi and you said, look, you know, what's the story? Do you think this chicken had a wing broken after it died? Or was its wing broken when it was alive and it may not be kosher, etc.? When the rab makes a sack on the chicken, the chicken's kosher. The chicken is kosher. To the point, it may well be that another rabbi who disagrees cannot make the chicken tray. It's very interesting. Okay. Rabbi Wein, again, he told me once his father was the rabbi of a shtetl in Eastern Europe, whatever, and they had one cow for the shtetl. That's all. And if the cow was kosher, they ate meat on Shabbos. And if the cow was treif, they didn't eat meat on Shabbos. They had one cow a week. He said, and every Thursday night, his father, the rabbi, and the shoichet, used to sit there all night with this cow, looking at this mangled old, manky old, half-dead cow, trying to work out some way to find that this cow was kosher, so that people would have something to eat on Shabbos. Like, it was this, like, Nebuch, this cow on its last legs, trying to work out how this possibly can be kosher. But, you know, they found usually a way to try and paskin that it was kosher, so that people could eat meat on Shabbos. That's why they used to have their weddings on Friday night. Because you can't afford to eat meat on Tuesday and on Shabbos. You had one cow and that was it. You had the cow for the wedding, you had the cow for the Shabbos, and that was it. Anyway, let's have a look at the Ritzvah. The Ritzvah is a very famous approach in source number 6 and 7, based on the Midrash of Chazal. Chazal say number 6, Amar Rabbi Yanai, Loi Nitna Divrei Torah Chatikin. The Torah wasn't given in like sound bites, in like fixed little chunks. Everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicated to Moshe, Hayom mementis panim tahora mementis panim tameh. He'd give him 49 different perspectives to say it was pure, and 49 different perspectives to say it was impure. Amar lefanav, Ribbono shel Olam, Moshe turns around to God and says, Ribbono shel Olam, matay na'amar lo birur shel davar, how can I get any clarity here? You know, I'm Moshe Rabbeinu, they're going to expect an answer from me. If you call up your rabbi and you say to him, is this meat kosher? And your rabbi answers, oh, well, that's a fascinating question, because here are 49 ways of understanding how the meat's kosher, and here are 49 other ways of understanding how the meat's trade. Don't you think that's interesting? The answer will be, fascinating, but can I eat it? So he says to God, I need a bit of clarity here. The Medrash says, Amalei, oh, clarity. God says to him, Achrei Rabbi Mahatos, follow the majority. Rabba Matame and Tame, if the majority say it's Tame, so then it's Tame. Rabba Matarim, if the majority say it's Tahor, Tahor, then it is Tahor. But says God to Moshe, I want you to know that built into the thing itself are 98 potential ways of seeing it, 49 this way, 49 this way. What's with 98? What's with 49? What's the number 49 represent?
7 times 7.
7 times 7, good. Which means?
An
expansion
of...
1 second. An expansion of the...
Sinai?
Right. In other words, the 49th level is the maximal level of human understanding. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was able to achieve. The 50th level is always represents the idea of the beyond. We never get to 50. That's why on Sefirat HaOmer, the mitzvah is to count 50 days, but we only ever count 49 days. We never hit the 50th level. Okay? So here too, I've got a Baruch, this number 49 means that Moshe was given by God the maximum way of understanding this way and this way. And the Ritva, who lived in Spain in the 14th century, just 1 second, says like this, look at number 7. Eivele di Reitim Chai. Shalu Rabbani Tarfat. The rabbis of France asked the following question. Hey Chesha Sheyu Shneihem di Reitim Chai. How can they possibly be the words of God? Vezeu Oysa Vezeu Maka, when they're saying the opposite things. How can that be true? But Tinsu, and they answered, Kikshalom Moshe the Maroni, quotes this Medrash, from Moshe Hashem Haile, Kabbal Torah, Hiraola, Koldava, Vadava, Mentis, Panim, the Isav, Mentis, Panim, the Hetzah. God told him 49 ways of seeing it this way, 49 ways of seeing it this way. But Shalom Kodesh Baruch Hu, there he asked God what to do with this multiplicity. But Amar, and he said to him, Sheizem, Masul, Lachachmi, Israel, Shabacholdor, Vador, the answer, the practical answer will be handed over to the rabbis in every generation. The Yiach Ra Kamoisam, and they would decide what the truth was. And different generations could decide different ways. It could be in one generation they decided it was Osir, and another generation they decided it was Mutter. So, but that's just a practical question. What the Rabbi is saying is built in is the potential for plurality. And he says at the end, Benochon Hulafi Adrash, this is a correct understanding. Ubederech HaEmes, but on a Kabbalistic deeper level, Yesh Tam V'Soy V'Devil, there's even deeper explanations. Fine. What the Ritva is saying, based on this Midrash, is that Eilu Ve'Eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim means that the Torah was given with the potential for different understandings. Which makes a lot of sense, because the Torah is infinite. The Torah is given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It wasn't just written by a group of people, and therefore we have to work out the intention of the author. Because, look at it, I mean, it's a very interesting question, is when you're interpreting a piece of text, is it a fallacy to try and work out what the author intended? Or is that the purpose of interpreting? I mean, there are people who do PhDs on this kind of thing. There's a very interesting book by a fellow called Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish was a professor of, I think, law and a professor of English a while ago, and he wrote a book called Is There a Text in This Class? Okay, I don't know where I came across this book, but I'm reading it at the moment. It's all about questions of how you interpret text. It's nothing to do with Judaism. It's just a book about textual analysis and what text means, and are we trying to look at the intention of the writer, or are we trying to look at the reality of the meaning based in the reaction of the reader? And is that the reality of the meaning? The Ritva, it seems to be saying here, it's the author's intention that is key, but if the author is God, then the intentions are infinite, or at least multiple. Now, it doesn't mean that every answer is right. It doesn't mean that anybody's answer is right. Because you can be way off. You can think, you know, 2 plus 2 is 96. Well, that's my perspective. That's not good enough. But it does mean that built into an infinite system is a plurality of understandings. And that's good machlokas. Okay? The Maharshal has a similar but different perspective in number 8. He's also into a pluralistic model, but he's looking at it from the receiver's point of view. Have a look at number 8. This is a fascinating source. He's a key halachist. He wrote a book called the Yamshel Shlomo, which is a book of analysis of Gemara. Okay, Shlomo Luria. Shlomo Luria lived in Poland in the 1500s. He was a contemporary of the Ramah. It's a really important Ashkenazi, early Polish Ashkenazi poisek. He says, "Hamukubalim kasvu tamla davar." The Kabbalists have explained it like this: Lefisha kol haneshamas hayu b'Har Sinai. Every neshama was at Har Sinai. The Kibru Derech Mem Tes Nitsinoiris, and they received through 49 different channels. Now, what's a tsinor? In modern Hebrew, what's a tsinor? A pipe, a faucet. It means here like a channel. Tsinor means a channel, and I want you to think in terms of not just channels of pipes, but channels of broadcasts. We also say channel, it's very interesting. Not in modern Hebrew, we don't say tsinor, I don't think, for a. We say what? Arutz, yeah, Arutz Sheva, Arutz this, Arutz, okay. So here is using the word Sinai. The Heim HaKolot, these are the voices, which we heard at Sinai, Asher Shama, which we heard, the Gamra'u, and we also saw. You're familiar with the Pasuk from this week's Parsha, Yisrael, okay? That they saw the voices at Sinai. What does it mean they saw the voices? And you can't see something audible. So he says, you're missing the point. Number one, kol doesn't mean a voice. And number two, saw doesn't mean saw. The kolot were the downloads, were the broadcasts of information at Sinai. And the seeing was their picking up these downloads on their, you know, receiving mode. That's what's going on. And if when we, the way we describe prophecy, I mean, we talked about prophecy, you can understand a little bit what's going on here, that there are people kind of tuning in. Although it's a debate between the Rishonim as to what level of prophecy the people had at Har Sinai, as opposed to Moshe. But that's off topic. So let's have a look at what he says. Second line. The Kol Yisrael Roi Ben Kolas, all the Jewish people saw this information. Heim Hadeos, these are the knowledge, is the knowledge. The Kol is the knowledge. Hamichal Kois B'Tzinoi, which are all divided into different channels. Kol Echod Ra Derech Tzinoi Shalai, and every person at Sinai saw through his own channel. Lefi hashagasa, according to his own understanding, the kibbal lefi koyach nishmaso, and received the Torah according to the strength of his own neshama, helyona leroi biguya or chisura, but there are chagos there, each one different from the other, higher and lower. Ache echad yagia letahor, until one person could stand at Har Sinai, listen to the Torah, and say, "Oh, God says that this is tahor." The hasheni and the guy standing next to him, yagia lekitzeach, can hear the same thing. And comes to the opposite conclusion, say Tami. The Hashlishi and the third guy standing between them, Lem Tos, can come to a middle ground. Rochok min hakatzois, v'chachol emes, and each one of them is true. And the Maharshal is basically saying that the plurality, not so much is from the giver's perspective, but the receiver's perspective. When God gives the Torah, he gives it to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people all receive it in a slightly different way. Where if we're like a chelik elo kamimah, we're all like a chip of the diamond of God, we all reflect the light in a slightly different way. No two diamonds are identical, and therefore the light reflected back or refracted through the diamond, everyone will have a different, you know, I don't know anything about diamond refractions, but everyone will have a different pattern. Okay? No two will be the same. And by the way, we say this, we make a brocha on this. There's a brocha in the siddur. You better remember this because you might not have your siddur with you when you need to make this bracha. When you see 600,000 Jewish people together, which is like a replay of the moment of Har Sinai, which to my knowledge hasn't happened for a long time, 600,000 Jewish people together, there's a bracha you have to say. It's in your art scroll siddur. But as I say, you might not have your siddur with you when you walk around the corner one day and see 600,000 Jewish people in front of you. Although I imagine there'll be some elements of planning for that. The bracha you say is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Chacham Harazim. Chacham Harazim. Chacham Harazim. The wise one of all secrets. That's a strange bracha. So the Gemara says in brachas, the reason for this bracha is as follows. That just like these people have 600,000 different faces. No two people in the world have the same face, which is remarkable if you think about it. How many variations can there be on a face? And yet, billions and billions of people all have different faces. So too, says the Gemara, each one of these 600,000 people has different ways of seeing the world. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows all of those people's views, even though they're all different. And the Gemara is basically comparing the different faces of the people to their different viewpoints. In that sense, when you walk in the room to my class, just like I don't expect you to check in your face at the door and take my face when you sit in my class, that wouldn't be pleasant for most of you, okay? I don't expect you to take my viewpoint either. You have your own viewpoint. Now, your viewpoint might not necessarily be correct on everything, and neither might mine. We're not infallible. But it means there's a certain legitimacy to the different viewpoints of the Klal Yisrael. I brought you the classics, you know, Wittgenstein's rabbit. You know, is it a rabbit? Is it a bird? Which is it? Depends on where you look at it. It's certainly a rabbit. It's certainly a bird. It just depends on your perspective. You go to it in the street and show it to kids and say, Mazer. I'd be interested. I reckon half of them will say it's a rabbit and half of them say it's a bird. Okay? Similarly, the one number on page 3, I brought you the old woman, young woman perspective. And you can see, hopefully you can see both of these drawings. They're just two different drawings of the same thing. One of them is slightly more detailed than the other, but you can hopefully see the young woman in each looking, you know, in a profile to the, you know, to the side, and the old woman looking in a fuller profile with a big hook nose and a sort of warty chin and all that kind of stuff.
Do you think that people with similar faces also have similar perspectives?
I don't know anything about that. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I would have thought if they're using their brains right, and I'm not sure their face is a good representation of their... Look, they say that some people have intelligent-looking faces. I don't know what that means, though, exactly. You got it, Tommy? You got it?
Part of God's omnipotence is being able to understand, like, all perspectives at once.
Yes. Correct. Whereas we all see them as a bifurcated system. You can look at it later, Tom. It's okay. Fine. Once you see it, you'll go, oh, how could I not see it? So that's an approach to pluralism. I brought you here, although I didn't bring you all the sources because I just don't have time. There's an entire book about this, by the way, available in English. There are many books on this kind of issues, but the best book I recommend is a book called The Open Canon. The Open Canon by a writer called Avi Sagi. An Israeli writer, Avi Sagi, S-A-G-I. You can pick it up on Amazon. It's out in Hebrew, it's out in English. Apparently the English one is fuller than the Hebrew one. It's got more in it. He's an academic. He's not a rabbinic figure. But he is. He's analysed all the different sources on Elu Ve'elu and brought them together in a book. It's about 200 or 300 pages long, and basically is dedicated to this. It's quite a tough read. You know, if you sit down and read that book cover to cover, you're really quite serious about the subject, but I'm sure you are. He also mentions there a more mystical approach. Rav Kook talks about this, Rav Dessler of the Maharal, that things seem from our perspective to be opposites, but actually from the perspective of God, they are actually one. Which, even though it might not be an intellectually satisfying answer, it's a logical answer, because we see this a lot with other areas, in the sense that from we see life from our human perspective, and often things look separate and distinct. Whereas we know somehow from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, there's a unity, there's an ichud, there is a grand unifying theory of everything, okay? Which actually links everything up, and it just doesn't seem that way from our perspective. So true. That's also true of the issue of plurality of halachic understanding. Now, I'm not going to look at the second model now. I'm going to look at it next time. I just want to bring you just before we leave the other main example of Elu Elu Nivra Elu Kachayim, and then next time I want to come back to see. So just bring this sheet with you next time, and we'll cover this next time because it's a shame not to cover it. But I want you to bring you the Midrashic analysis. You could also argue that even the Beis Hillel Beis Shammai could be Midrashic as well, but this is definitely Midrashic, which is the other main place it's brought. It's the Pilegish B'Givah. And here, it's even more fascinating. This is not really a halachic, but but I brought it because it's of interest in the last 3 minutes, just so you're aware of it. Gemara and Gittin. But Tizna Alav Pelagshoi. So you know the story of the Pelagish Begiva, that there was a man, okay, from the went to the tribe of Binyamin, and he had a Pelagish with him, as a concubine, and the concubine did something to upset him. It says that she's patizna, she did a znut, she did something negative to him, and he threw her out of the house. And what happened is the men from the tribe of Binyamin, this is, you can see the episode at the end of Sefer Shoftim, the men from the tribe of Binyamin came and abused her overnight and killed her. They raped and abused her and killed her and left her dead on the floor. Okay. The next morning he opens the door and sees his Pelegesh dead on the floor, and sees what they've done to her, and he chops her into pieces. It's a terrible story, and no one comes out of it looking very good, frankly. And no one's suggesting that this guy is a big tzaddik by any means. But he chops her into pieces, and he sends a little bit of a body to all round the Jewish people, saying, look, this is what the tribe of Binyamin are doing to people. Are you going to sit there and stand for this, or are you going to do something about it? And this was a rallying cry for the Jewish people to gather, and there was a civil war against the tribe of Binyamin to kind of root out this evil, you know, within the people. And there was a terrible situation. Most of the tribe of Binyamin was killed. Anyway, that's the story. You can learn it in Tanakh. But here in number 12, it says, "But tizna alav pelagshoi." What?
Do they teach this to children?
Not just before they go to sleep, no. Yes, I mean, it's all there. They don't censor the Tanakh, I'm aware, as far as I'm aware, in any of the schools. But maybe they don't use it as the prime text. But let's just have a look at what he says here. This is fascinating, and then we'll go. What did she do that was so terrible that God had thrown out? Rebbe Eviatar Amar, Zvuv Matzalah. He found a fly. The husband found a fly. Where? We'll see. And he threw her out. Rabbi Yonatan Amar, Rabbi Yonatan says, Nima Matzalah. No, the husband found a hair. Okay. You done this? You learned this before? The Ashikhe Rabbi Atal Eliyahu. And Rabbi Atal found Eliyahu Novi. Now here they're arguing ostensibly about a historical fact. Or are they? And again they found Eliyahu Novi. But Amalein, they said to him, or Rabbi Atal said to him, Maika Avid HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's the Kadosh Baruch Hu doing when we're arguing about whether it was a fly or a hair? Because we can't both be right. So Eliyahu said to him, Amalei, he said, oh, it's interesting you ask that. Asik b'Pelegish b'Givah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is learning the parasha of Pelegish b'Givah. Umaita, so what's he say? So Eliyahu answers him, Amalei, God's saying the following. Eviatar b'ni kachu amer. My son Eviatar says that this is what happened. V'yonatan b'ni kacha amer. And Yonatan, my son Yonatan says this is what happened. In other words, God seems to be learning the sugya according to the way that the rabbis are learning it. Which is really interesting. Amalei, Rabbi Eviatar says to him, chas v'sholem. God forbid. Does God not know what happened? He's learning it out like me and like him. Amalei, he said, they are both words of the living God. Zvuv matzah, then he tries to put them together. Zvuv matzah, he found a fly and he didn't care so much. V'nima matzah, v'hikpid, and then he found a hair and he did care. And Rabbi Yehuda Zvuv Bakari found a fly in the plate of Aniba Boy Samachem, and the hair was a whole other thing, which I'm not going to get into right now, but I can talk to you about it afterwards if you like. Okay? And they're trying to put together the fact that both of these can be true at the same time, but somehow or other they need to be true at the same time. Now, I'm not going to go into an analysis of this Midrash. I only brought it to you for your awareness that this, you've now seen the two main situations in the Gemara where Elu ve'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim appear. One with Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, and one here with the Pelegish V'Givah, which I admit I haven't really done in any sense properly. But again, if you're interested in this, the other place to look on this, and I'm going to give you an interesting source here, and I'm going to finish with this, one of my very close friends is a rabbi called Rabbi Harvey Belofsky. He's a rabbi in London, and he about 2 years ago wrote a PhD on this particular issue. Including this issue and other issues as well, on his website, rabbibelofsky.com, okay, You will find he's uploaded the entire PhD as a PDF document. And if you ever felt like reading about 30 pages of really interesting analysis on the Eilid of William Chaim, you can find in the middle of his PhD, it's all very, very well indexed, you can find a really good analysis of this. Because he's extremely bright, and his analysis is very on the point. But there are other books as well to read about this, but I'm just bringing this to your attention so you're aware of it, so that you don't think that we haven't made an effort. Okay, let's leave it there. More next week. Sorry to go over a few minutes.